Thank you very much for those kind words, David, and thank you for inviting me. Is that your iPad? Look, it's lovely to be here, and especially with the Foundation of Science and Technology. I'm mostly wearing my Imperial College hat on, as David has said. I spend a lot of time looking at science and innovation. But could I put my Monetary Policy Committee hat on for a second? This is very dangerous because the Monetary Policy Committee takes no view on R&D. But it's to react to something that Grant just said, which is this. Often in the newspapers, when the ONS revise their data, there's some sort of apocalyptic headline saying, Monetary Policy Committee, clash with ONS, revisions of data, and this, that, and the other. Can I just make it very clear that that is absolutely not the case? What you've heard from Grant is that the ONS have indeed revised the data, but they've revised the data because they've got better data. They've got more exchange of data from other institutions. They've processed it in a better way. There is nothing wrong with that whatsoever. So I just want to start the conversation, if I may, by putting that hat on, by putting all this, by putting that that into context. Okay, so let me go more then onto the sort of intangible side. How do these R&D revisions change UK performance? I gave a talk last summer where I put up this diagram here. This is from the OECD website. This again is last summer. It shows the problem which David in his introduction and Grant has just been talking about. The British R&D to GDP ratio is in red. The OECD average is in black. You can see that we're lagging behind. And so I thought I'd try to be a bit conscientious and update this slide and see what the latest is. And here it is. You can see that the British R&D now looks rather better, but unfortunately it appears like the back series has not been updated. So this is under the heading of here that there are many moving parts to this R&D story. So the first thing we need to understand is it might be that the level has changed, but we need to understand what the back data is about there as well. So I don't know if you can see, sorry, for those of you maybe at home, on the right-hand side, the red line suddenly goes up. Right in 2014, which I think was, Grant, the first year of your slide, when the ONS revision has been. So we're going to have to be careful as a community when we start monitoring these things, especially making these international comparisons, to get all this stuff right. So that's one moving part behind all of this. So one might ask the question, if you did try to backcast this data, what would it look like? The blue line is the business share of R&D. The red line is on the far right, is Grant's figures, which you just saw a second ago. And then I've sort of drawn a straight line, if you see what I mean, back to the blue line under the assumption that with the R&D tax credit, which started around the 2000s, maybe those two lines would intersect. So one might want to do that, for example, and then build up, a broader picture of what all these things are. But then, of course, the next bit of the moving part is to convert the nominal R&D spend, because this is a pound, shillings and pence number, into real spend. And there we also get into another difficulty illustrated in this chart here. These are the R&D deflators across different countries. What I mean by that, we have to divide this nominal by a deflator in order to get real euros, real pounds, real dollars, whatever it might be. And as you can see, there are a variety of R&D deflators which are used across different countries. So that grey is the swathe between all of the countries except Japan, who's at the very top. So those are the European countries. And you can see that some European countries think that the price of doing R&D has been, if I start at the very bottom left there, has been growing quite a lot. If you then divide an R&D number by that high growing number, you get a rather smaller number, if you see what I mean, in real terms, than if you take one of those flatter numbers. So there's differences across different countries about how this nominal spend converts into real volume. And what's the UK number? So the UK number looks like this. It's this black line here, which is rising sharply. It's right at the bottom of the swathe there, and then rises particularly sharply after 2015, which means that essentially we're going to be dividing a UK trend of R&D by an relatively aggressively rising number. That's going to give us less real R&D than in other countries. So apologies if that's all a bit of a tangled explanation about how you get all this stuff. But it's another part of these moving parts. And so I think we also need to understand as a community, not only how it is that we get these nominal R&D figures, but the real R&D, which is underneath all of that. And again, making these international comparisons extremely difficult. So that's another issue I wanted to sort of put on the table. Now, how does this fit in more generally? David, if you'll forgive me, give me a little bit of latitude to sort of talk more broadly about all of this. So this is investment as a whole. The blue line is the volume of investment since 1997. And the red line carries on the trend if the pre-Brexit trend in investment had carried on. And you can see that the red line is above the blue line. So this updates a little bit of work that I did last year, which suggests that unfortunately, when we voted for Brexit, I shouldn't say unfortunately, that's what people voted for. And as again, my Bank of England hat on, I put to have no view on that. But just what are the economic consequences of all of that? The economic consequences, unfortunately, is that investment, that blue line, was much flatter relative to the previous trend. So I think that's part of the picture that we're labouring underneath. Now, as it turns out, if you do R&D and you do the same exercise, these are intellectual property estimates. This is R&D and software and artistic originals. It turns out that actually those numbers look rather the same. There hasn't been much change in the trend. Which suggests that maybe Brexit wasn't too bad on the R&D side. But then that gets us back to how it is we're measuring all of this stuff and whether we're doing it in a consistent kind of way. So I think there's some puzzles around all of that as well. A couple more slides and then I'll stop. If we broaden out the discussion, David very kindly mentioned my work that I've been doing with Stian Westlake. What we stress is that the modern economy is indeed a knowledge economy, and R&D is an important part of that knowledge, but it's just one of a whole group of intangible investment. And I just wanted to put some of them on the page there for you. Software databases, R&D, we've mentioned artistic originals, I mentioned that before. All of those are included in the GDP numbers, but other types of knowledge investment, design, training, branding, the kind of business process re-engineering under the name of organizational capital, they're not included. So again, I think it's all part of a broader picture of understanding the kind of knowledge economy that we're moving into. And where that takes you is this, again, apologies for this rather busy diagram. This shows where the intangible investment is in the economy. And broadly speaking, the left-hand industries are the manufacturing industries, the right-hand industries are the services industries. That just happens to be how they're numbered. If one does this for R&D, lots of R&D is carried out in manufacturing, in aerospace, in chemicals and all of that. But what you can see if one looks at this broader set of measures is that lots of intangible investment is carried out everywhere, in particular in the service sector as well. That suggests if one wants to understand productivity in the service sector, it's not only R&D, but it's this broader range of investment as well. My final slide is entitled R&D and Beyond, and here's a couple of kind of talking points that maybe we could take up. I think the evidence still carries on suggesting that public sector R&D is complementary to private sector R&D, and that public sector R&D has a spillover up to private sector R&D as well. David kindly mentioned our work, and that's been updated as well, and I think similar findings are forthcoming on that. Second issue around stability and certainty. If there's one thing that investment needs, I think it's stability and uncertainty, and the instability that unfortunately that has been around in the economy for reasons outside of our control, for reasons in our control, has hurt investment. I've got AI there, artificial intelligence. So how does artificial intelligence fit into all of this? Some of it, of course, is embodied in software. Some of it is, of course, embodied in databases. Those are reasonably well and perhaps not quite so well measured in the data as well, so that's yet another challenge. But the broader issue with AI, it seems to me, is whether AI is in itself an innovation in doing innovation. Right? Maybe it's going to help the scientific community, which Ottolin is supporting so strongly. Maybe it might help the scientific community do innovations more quickly and more readily as well. So that would be a very optimistic source of future productivity. One last slide, if I may, is the wider reach of R&D and intangibles. Again, if we think about these intangibles more broadly than R&D and think of them being outside the manufacturing sector, that raises the intriguing issue about getting productivity gains in what have hitherto been rather hard to improve sectors such as health and so on. So let me leave it there. Thanks very much.